Running a business is hard work. Building your website shouldn't be. With Wix, you can express your ideas, give direction, then leave the heavy lifting to AI, from site creation to branded content and images. Have fun with the details. Customize what you want, the way you want, and manage your whole business from a centralized dashboard with expert AI tools. Build, scale, and enjoy the incredible results. You can do it all yourself on Wix.
Life insurers put life into the things you live for. The new factory that's hiring your neighbors. Maintenance on the bridge that keeps traffic flowing. The paycheck that puts pizza night on the table. Life insurers contribute $8 trillion to communities and local economies through bond purchases and other investments. And protect the financial security of 90 million American families. Like yours. See how life insurers put life into America at ACLI.com. Paid for by the American Council of Life Insurers.
Go loud.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your whip in the ground. Till your body is dead. Walk it hard and long. When you finish that.
Deep knocker.
Episode 217 of the Talk About Us podcast, brought to you by Go Loud. It's me, COB.
It's me, Thirty Flower.
So anyone who follows us on social media or was listening to Talk About Us last week, expecting to hear the main episode but got a bonus episode, will know that we ventured outside of Dublin for the first time ever to record a podcast. We went to Belfast and we had a plan to release the episode on that day, but we actually recorded over our schedule. We went over the scheduled time that we had in the podcast studio that we had booked up in Belfast. So because of that, we're playing catch-up now. You have got a bonus episode instead of a main on Thursday. But to make up for that, we're giving you three main episodes this week.
One today, one tomorrow, and one on Thursday. So the reason we went to Belfast is because there was a guest that we've wanted on for a long, long time. And he agreed to do it. So we said we'll make the trip up to Belfast and record it. And it's with Sam Miller.
So around the same time we joined Go Loud in the summer of 2021, our producer Owen, he done his own podcast series called Unusual Suspects that goes into detail of Sam Miller's story from when he was in the IRA, growing up in the Troubles in Belfast. He was the last man on the blanket protesting the H blocks, smuggled himself into America.
Went on to rob 8 million.
He opened up a comic book shop, got involved with a dodgy priest, got out as part of the Good Friday Agreement, and there's still a load of details that we're missing out there.
So this episode is basically after taking about 3 years to get across the line. And as Calvin's had to explain, it's a mad old story. So look, it was worth the wait for us and we hope it's worth the wait for you as well.
So we had to jump through a lot of hoops to get this episode over the line, as Terry was saying. But as you can imagine, Sam Miller is a hard man to get a hold of and doesn't like leaving Belfast. So that's why we had to trek up there. Go crack on the train, annoyed home for a while, and then we are drained coming home. We actually had to run through Belfast to catch the train home. We nearly missed it. So the three episodes, you'll get part one today, you'll get part one of Unusual Suspects tomorrow, and then part two goes out on Thursday.
But for now, here's Sam.
Just a little more.
Right, we'll kick this off then.
Yeah.
Sam, what's your name, where do you come from, and tell us what life was like growing up for you.
Name Sam Miller. It's a good orange name because my grandfather was a good orange man. But it's a strange sort of a family connection because half my family's orange, they are half Republican. And in Belfast, that's quite a gunpowder combination, you know. But it helped me be able to go into different areas without really worried about being murdered or anything through the sectarian, because I've got a lot of cousins and uncles who are loyalists. And later on in life, whenever I'd be doing interviews, journalists would always say, well, how would you know how Protestants and loyalists live? But they say, this is where I always get them, because I lived all the summers with my loyalist cousins and my loyalist aunts and all, you know. So it always confuses the journalists, you know what I mean? But at a very young age, I was about 8 years of age, my mother walked out one day, she never came back. And it sort of affected me mentally as a boy, you know what I mean? Had a big, big burden on my life. And I grew up with in a family where you had to look after yourself more or less, you know, fend for yourself, brothers and sisters and all, like it was tough. But my father was a seaman all his life, merchant seaman, and for him it was terrible because all of a sudden he had to give up the life that he loved and become a father with these kids and look after them. And he was out of his depth, you know, it was no use to him, you know.
You said your mother walked out when you were eight.
Yes.
Did you, what happened there with that?
she was always cutting herself and overdosing, and she was always getting rushed to hospital. So it was a sort of a thing that you sort of expect. It was a very embarrassing thing. You know, you look back now, as we realize, I was embarrassed because I was doing these terrible things. You lived in a tight-knit community, one street along College Street, a very famous street in Belfast, because it's mostly Republicans. And the thing about Lancaster Street, three of my father's brothers lived in it and two of his sisters. It was a big, big Republican family. So this sort of thing was like really a scandal and it was hid. Mm. Then one morning I remember waking up and my mum used to always have the breakfast ready, head off to school, and she wasn't there. But I there was just something going on, silence. None of my brothers were talking, my father wouldn't talk. And I just remember getting my aunt coming for me, it was unusual, and she brought me to school. And nobody said anything, but my mum had walked out. And this went on for weeks. Nobody would speak about it. But I was scared. But where is she? And then it started to affect me because I was waiting for her coming home any day. So, of course, years go by. As I get a bit older, I'm still waiting for her coming home this day. And it fucked my head up. Like, you know what I mean? Like, but nobody ever talked about it. So I had deep depression. And you weren't allowed to talk about people. But in those days, depression was like a shame. Mm. You never talked about it, especially working class. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, and it wasn't through horror, like, you know what I mean? But I grew up to hate her. Because I thought, what did I do? Must have done something terrible at your mum. Imagine your mother walking out and disappearing. Never seen her again. Off the face of the earth. Like, you know what I mean? It was, and it affected me every day. It wasn't something that lasted for a couple of years. Every day of my life, I thought, my mates used to say, Sam, where's your mum? I said, oh, she's upstairs, she's sick. And he used to say, fuck, she's been sick. You know, it's like a Guinness Book of Records. You know, she's been up there for years sick. But I used to be scundered. You know what I mean? Every time somebody asked me for it, you know, and this went on. People still asked me when I was 20, and I was still saying, oh, she's always so sick, you know what I mean? Because it was just something deep inside you, the shame. It wasn't until years later, and you get to know about depression and what people went through, and you sort of understand it, you know? But yeah. It really affected me. I think if my mother had been alive, my life would have took a different route. There's no doubt about it. She'd have been more stricter on me. I was a baby of family, you know, and she always protected me. I know she was really looking after me. And I think if she had still been alive or still had been in the house, there's no doubt about it, my life wouldn't be, I wouldn't be sitting here today talking to you, you know what I mean? Something like that. Mm. But later on in life, my first reality to what was happening in the North, I was really ignorant to it. My brothers were all politically aware and Republicans. My father's a real staunch Republican, well-known family. But I really was only interested in discos, girls, and having a bit of drink, having a bit of fun. And my brothers were always trying to get me involved in the history of Ireland and all, but as I say, I was just a young lad, I didn't really care too much, you know what I mean? Like, but a couple of things affected me, and one was when I was about 15, my friend Jim Kerr, we both of us just got out of school, we're planning things, I got a terrible job, I was working in a slaughterhouse, it was a terrible, terrible job, and especially when it's like 95% loyalist, 5% Catholic, it's a real tough, tough job, so it was, you know, a lot of shankle busters came from it. But my friend and I, Jim Kerr came down, he was living a wee bit distance away, and he was telling me about he had just got a job up in Lisburn, not too far from here, and he was working in a garage, and I was envious of him because I was working in this shithole in the slaughterhouse in the abattoir, and here he was working to be a mechanic, fixing cars and all, and for me it would have been a dream. But he says, don't you worry, Sam, see, after a couple of months I'll try and get you in. So I was delighted then, you know. So about 2 days later, Jim was murdered. He was shot 6 times in the head by loyalists for being a Catholic. He was under the car working. They pulled him out from underneath the car, shot him 6 times in the head and threw him back in under the car as if he was garbage. So that sort of was a shock to me. You know, it really put me in a deep depression. Didn't know it was depression I was going through at the time, you know what I mean? Because here was my good friend and I just murdered for nothing.
So up until then, Sam, you said you were just living the life of like a normal teenage boy.
Yes.
Growing up, going to discos, just wanting to be with your friends. Were you unaware of what's going on around you, or did you kind of just turn a blind eye to that kind of stuff?
Well, the thing was, my grandfather, I went to a field on the 12th of July with my grandfather, the Orange, and the 12th of July were all the Orange gathering, so I didn't really see too much of what was going on. My father-in-law, like, knew, I don't know why they tried to shelter me from it, but I wasn't really into politics or such. I was into America, I was a big, big American comic book fan, you know, and I was always into my comics, probably daydreaming. Instead of reading Irish history books like all my brothers were doing, my sisters and all were doing, I was reading American comic books, Marvel and DC, Spider-Man, the X-Men, all this here. So I suppose it was a bit of a head case, you know what I mean? Like, but my life didn't really have an impact from the war that was about to take place until afterwards when I got a bit older and realised, how the fuck was I living like this, like a second-class citizen? When I seen the state of the house that I lived in, my family was forced to live in, it's only then you start to realise that you're a dog. what you're being treated like a shit pad, like a slave, you know. But that time, of course, I didn't see any of this here, you know what I mean? It was all news to me. But once Jim was murdered, it started to change me drastically.
Sam, you said you had cousins who are Protestants and loyalists. Mm-hmm. And then you said when you were older, you looked back at your house and you said you were living like a second-class citizen.
Big time.
What was their life like? So I'd imagine you would have went to their houses then if you were able to look at your house different.
When you're a kid, you don't look at them things.
Yeah.
You just notice they're going on holidays no more. Because I used to get offered holidays no one, but my father said, no, you're not going. No, he has prayed because we never went on holidays. Holidays was unheard of, you know what I mean? But they would be going, you know. And they would say, oh, I said, my Johnny wants me to go. You're not be going anywhere, you know. It's bad enough that you're going, I'm letting you go where, blah, blah, blah. The houses were different. They were always neater, brighter, lots of stuff in them, you know what I mean? Like, our fucking houses were like, it's hard to explain, you know what I mean? You were just about barely living, but as a kid, you didn't see it. You know, I didn't give a shit what a house looked like, you know what I mean? Like, but you sort of realise when you look back, like, and you think, how the fuck did I live here? I mean, food was scarce, you know? I'm not trying to say, oh, poor me, poor me. Just trying to tell you a fact, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now, jobs, there was no jobs. My cousins were guaranteed a job. Doesn't matter what their education was, they were going straight into a job. For a job for us, you're fucking fighting like for it. You know what I mean? Especially when they know you're a Catholic. What school you went to? That's the first thing they asked you. What school did you go to? And I used to get away with it because my name's Sammy Muller. It's an orange name. It's a big loyalist name. You know, I used to get away with a lot of things. I wouldn't have got away if I had been Paddy Murphy or something.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, but looking back on it, it was disgraceful the way we had to live. Nationalists and Catholics were just like nothing. You know, it's just the way the blacks were treated in America and the way the Palestinians are being treated right now at this moment as we speak. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You said your friend got shot. Did that change your life then from there and your views and everything?
Big time. It took something like that. I mean, my brothers used to do that, and I mean, used to see me going up the stairs. I'd be reading comics. I was a comic fanatic, like, you know what I mean? Like, and they would just shake their heads and say, catch you yourself on, wake up. You got to read what's going on around you here. What situation? There's situation coming down here. They were more or less warning me what's coming down. You know, they must have been hearing rumors and all, like, you know what I mean? Like, but I didn't give a crap what they were talking about, like, you know what I mean? Like, but it was only when Jim, here he was with me and him playing football on Lancaster Street, and that night, it was a lovely night, and that's the last I see him going. So he had to go back to the house. He lived about 3 miles away, you know what I mean? Says, look, I've seen a couple of days, mate. And that was it. Next thing, it's on the fucking news. He's shot there. It's only a wee lad, like, you know what I mean, Kelly? No reason whatsoever. It's Catholic, you know, in the head. 6 bullets.
It's shocking for us, Sam. That wasn't actually that long ago when you think about it.
No.
But I mean,
yeah,
we're from an hour down the road and this is going on. And I think it's just for people that are listening to this that would probably see the headlines or have a fair idea what happened. Mm-hmm. But these are the details that you're missing out on. Like, as you said, that was a fella who was walking on a car.
Exactly.
And he got shot because of his religion.
He's working right under it on one of them wooden things that they're working under the wheels, pulled him right under. Shot him 6 times then just doing right on there, so he's garbage, you know. Nicest guy in the world. And the strange thing about it, years later, when I'd done this interview with James English, I mentioned him, and I got an email from his sister, and she was saying, Sam, my mother seen the James English, and she cried her eyes out, because you're the first person to mention Jim. He's been forgotten about, you know. So that sort of way, it broke my heart, you know, but she was saying, my mother was so proud of you mentioning him. So it's just strange. It took like 40 odd years or 50 years for me to mention him again. For his mother to all of a sudden think, somebody remember Jim, you know?
Yeah. And Sam, Bloody Sunday had a big impact on you.
Bloody Sunday, once again, my brother Donnie, politically aware, knew about the civil rights and all. He was going to all these meetings and reading all these magazines and all. Like, you know, and he says to me, right, kid, we're going to Derry tomorrow. I had no clue where Derry was. I thought Derry was down the Free State somewhere. I was fucking missing. Brilliant. You know, I was telling all the mates, I ain't going to Derry. I had no clue where Derry was, you know, knew not a bit. So I went, him, myself, and his 2 mates, they had all these freaking pamphlets and all with them, you know what I mean? They were going to this big civil rights march. I didn't know if it was a civil rights march, didn't even know what it meant. But I always remember getting stopped by the cops on the way in towards the bog side, and they're fucking us around. You know, like, I remember getting slapped in the back of the head by a big cop and all. You know, I was fucking shocked. I was like, I didn't want to cry in front of my brothers. No, my brothers were cursing them out, and I thought, what's going to happen? I was terrified. What was happening? Just going into the box, and just remember getting close to the shooting. And I was going, what the hell is this? What's going on here? And then my brother just turned the car around. You could smell the gas, all its CS gas, and all was getting fired. I remember my brother turned the car around, he was pure white. And I didn't know it at the time. He was doing it for my sake. He was just scared that something was happening to me, not that something was going to happen to him. And I remember coming home. We never spoke. Nobody spoke in the car. Before we were all laughing and killing ourselves, my brothers all killing themselves, singing our songs and all. I remember walking into the house and my father, first time ever seen him, first and last time ever, crying his eyes out because he thought we were dead. You know, it was on the radio. People are being shot in Derry. And it was shocking to see my father. But listen, my father's a big man. Doesn't show emotions, you know. And I was shocked to see him. You know, it was the first time he ever rubbed his arms around me. He said, I thought you were dead. You know, terrible. Shocking thing, like, you know.
How did that day change your life?
Well, I joined the Republican Movement 2 days later.
Right.
I never wanted to join the Republican Movement because I said no interest. I was scared because I always heard these stories about ARA men with guns and all that. I thought guns and bombs, that's terrifying. But a mate of mine, schoolmate, funny enough, one of Jim's, one of our mates out of school had joined prior to us, and he says, son, there's things coming here, we're going to be slaughtered. Unions are going to fucking slaughter us, you know. And you're going to either stand by and watch it or join up and defend our cities, our, you know, streets, neighbourhoods, whatever. And that was it. That was the start of me, the Republican Movement.
Yeah, because it sounds obviously frightening when you're saying it like that, when you join this Republican Army, especially when you're talking about who you are as a kid. You're into comic books.
Clearly.
And you want to go to discos and meet girls and just be a normal kid.
Exactly.
And then these two events kind of happened with your friend and then Bloody Sunday, and now you're like, right, I need to do something here.
Yep.
How do you kind of make that decision? Because it's drastic. It's not like, it's not an easy decision to make. Like, it's such a drastic decision to join. How do you do that?
If my mate had not asked me, see, my father had asked me, I wouldn't have done it. But my mate, and once he started talking about Jim, it was like, this is my mate. I went to school with him for 5-6 years, close, all three mates, four mates of us. And only when he says, son, do you not know what's happening? It's going to happen. You've seen Derry, you've seen what happened to Jim, you've seen Derry. It's happening, it's going to happen here in the New Lot. It's going to happen any time now. And you can either stand by and be slaughtered or do something about it. Nah, that was it. Only him telling me that. My bros were saying that all the time.
Yeah.
I didn't listen to him. Didn't listen to my father, you know.
And you feel like just the switch went off in your head?
Switch went off in my head. There and then I wanted to join this group that was going to defend these areas. And I was scared. Don't get me, I was terrified. But there was something to me saying, you have to do this. Because he was saying to me, Markers were saying to me, this is a choice we have, son. We can stand by and watch it and talk about it later when all these people are going to be killed. Or we can do something about it. That was my decision.
And how old are you at that stage, Sam?
I was only 15.
15?
15.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
So, still a kid.
Yeah. That's it. I mean, looking back now, I mean, in Belfast at 15, you're actually 20.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're a wee bit older than what you are. But I was an immature person. As I said, I was into fucking pop music and comics and discos. That's what my head was filled with, you know? My family, like, just thought I was a real lunatic. My brothers, who were staunch Republicans, going to plug on meetings all their lives. You know what I mean? I was fucking the oddball in the family. I was the black sheep. But that's the way I was.
Mm.
As I said, my mother had still me alive. I wouldn't have went the route I went. My mother said, no, you're not joining nothing. I knew that for a fact. She wouldn't let me join, even though my brothers and my father were members there as a Republican Army. She wouldn't let me join.
Do you feel like you are left with no choice but to join?
Well, you always have a choice, you know. But when you're young, you don't know about a choice.
Mm.
I'm just thinking, these gangs of loyalists are going to come in these years. I'm going to wipe us all out. I'm going to wipe my family out, my mates all out. These old people in the New Lodge Road, especially living up at this sort of a intersecting where there's loyalists and Catholics living. I was thinking about them all. Like, that's the way it was in my head. I was actually thinking we're coming in there now. I was panicking, like, where do we get these guns? How do you fire a gun? What do you do? You know, well, of course, this went on for a year but before anything happened. It was just a mental thing that you had in your head. They're coming now, they're coming now.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah. You said you went to your first meeting 2 days after Bloody Sunday, was it?
It was roughly, yes.
Yeah, a couple of days
it
after.
Was.
What was that like then for you?
It was strange because I went into a room and there was about seven teenagers and about four mature men. They're always ARA men, you know, and they're talking to us, they're trying to find out what you know. And all these young people were all knew all their stuff and all, like, they were saying about James Connolly and all. I was fucking saying, like, who the fuck is James Connolly and all this? And you know, I hadn't a clue. And he was asking me, well, why do you want to join here? Why would you? Why? And I said, well, these horns men are coming. I want to freaking make sure, freaking shoot a couple of them. He said, well, maybe we'll have to, we talk to you. We'll talk to you later. Because he obviously thought this is a remnant attack. Doesn't know what the hell he's in here for. Doesn't want to talk about shooting people, sectarianism, you know. So it more or less came down to later. And he explained, he said, look, we're not here to shoot horns men or Protestants or any of that nonsense. But we are here to defend our area. And if they come, that's different. Well, we'll shoot them. But don't be thinking every orange man, every Protestant's your enemy. I mean, he didn't know my family's half friggin' orange anyway, so it is, you know what I mean? Like, so it took a while to get things around my head. I was very, as I said, very mature, but I matured very quickly.
Yeah.
Within a year, I was a different person.
Did you join it with vengeance? Like, to get back at them?
I joined it with fear.
Really?
Thinking, I'm going to be shot dead. They're coming into my house tonight. You know, you have all this madness. They're coming in through the windows. They're coming in through the doors. I was the way I seen Bloody Sunday and Jim. And these things are going through my head now over the last frigging few months. And I'm thinking, they're coming in. And you've got the, you always knew the pillars were on their side. Like, we were always getting beaten up by the pillars. No matter what. See, once you come out of the new law, it's nice, you're spotted. You're getting beat up by the cops. You know, you're getting humiliated, big beat up the arse and all. And they think that's funny. And all the loyalists are sitting watching them laughing. You know what I mean? Like, you know. Mm. So you know this sort of a thing. These things are already in your head. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But nothing to do with vengeance per se. Maybe it had to be a bit of vengeance, yes.
Yeah.
But it definitely wasn't a priority for me. My priority was defence. I'm going to be shot dead here. Mm. You know?
So when you sign up, do they give you like a history lesson? Do you get in tune with what's going on and the cause and why and the agenda and stuff like that?
You would go to different lectures.
Yeah.
Different places, different houses within Belfast area, you know what I mean? Like, and you would listen. I mean, I'd be honest, at the start it was doing my head in because I had still all this Superman stuff in my head and they're trying to tell me about the man in 1916 and all. Like, and I found it exciting, but at the same time, it would go on too much. And I thought, fuck's sake, maybe it's time for me to leave. Like, I was all right going to be leaving, or I hadn't even joined up, like, sort of a thing, like, you know what I mean? But then you get into it, and you start realising, you know, and you start saying, this is your county, do you not know what's happening? And I tell you about the Free State. And I always wondered about the Free State, because I remember being down there once, I think it was down O'Meath or somewhere, and I always had this strange feeling, it's a different country. This is the thing I had as a young person, like, I always had this feeling, why do I have a feeling I'm in a different country? And this is Ireland, you know? But it's only when you get later and you start hearing about the history of Free State. I'm not starting to get into too much politics here about Michael Collins and all, you know what I mean? But I'm listening to all the Free State Taoiseachs and all, and they're talking about Palestine and all, it's great. But I always think, fuck, for 70 years, 100 years, we had to endure fucking horrors of unionist terrorism, you know, treated like fucking dogs, away like Palestinians, but just never opened your mouth once. And these are our brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
Down the fucking Free State.
Yeah.
But my father just used to say, he says, don't worry about them. One day it'll all come clear, he says, they're a different breed. And he was right, you know. It was like, they believed there was 26 counties, it was a republic. My father says, see, they're not very good at counting, they're not very good at arithmetic down in Free State. They don't understand what 32 means. It's hard for them to get past that number 26, you know. But I always wondered now, I'm saying, you know, watching, I don't even know what they call a Taoiseach now. What do you call the Taoiseach?
Micheál Martin.
Yes, Martin. So he's always, you know, he's rightly so. He's doing his big condemnations of the Zionists. Yeah. And I was a bit shocked. I mean, God, I was a bit shocked when he's coming out with his great statements, you know what I mean? But always I remember a couple of mates laughing and saying, fuck, wouldn't it be nice, Sam, if it had been like out there for us, for the unionists? But the unionists was always impure unionists. They've got them nationalists, and them nationalists are always causing trouble up there, impure unionists. What the fuck is it? I used to think, why did I think it? We're getting hammered by unions, and our brothers and sisters are saying this, these are troublemakers. Why don't you just live like fucking slaves? And live like second class, because you're causing all this trouble. And pure units are only doing the best they can.
Mm.
You know, that's a mentality I had. Still have it.
Yeah.
Still believe it, you know?
Yeah, it means a lot coming from someone like you, Sam, who's lived through it, rather than being told that this is how you think. I'd rather hear it from someone who's actually been on the ground and knows. Because I think there is a lot of naive people down south when it comes to the history of the North.
It's not the people's fault. A lot of historians twisted the whole history thing down there, and it was drilled in by the Catholic Church as well as the historians. And I mean, it's not a lot of people were brought up in the curriculum down there of anti-Northern friggin' history, you know what I mean? Forget about all that nonsense that's going up in the North, you know what I mean? Like, but we in the North, we live it every fucking day.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a separate country to us. Our country is the whole of Ireland.
Yeah.
We don't look upon, like, this is Ireland, the six parts, six counties, and 26 is a different country. 32, that's Ireland.
Yeah.
And anybody talks anything like that, like since 26 counties as a republic, I don't know if they're fucking illiterate or they're doing deliberately just to aggravate me. You know what I mean? Like, but I just sort of like sometimes just have to laugh at it, you know?
Yeah.
Sam, how old were you when you first went to prison?
I was 16.
And what did you go to prison for?
Went to prison. This is the funniest thing about it was, of all my family, I'm the one that ends up in prison. I mean, I've got all these fucking mad air, I mean, my family, and I'm the quietest guy in the world. And I'm the one to come looking for it, you know. So they got it all mixed up. They were looking for my brother, Donnie, and they couldn't find him. So the Brits and the Peelers came and they wrecked the house. It wasn't much to wreck, but what little there was in the house was fucking wrecked. And they grabbed me and they took me away to a place called Castlereagh. It's quite a quite a dodgy place, a fucking torture centre, you know. I was fucking shitting myself. And I says, they started accusing me of all these things, all these mad, ridiculous things, you know what I mean? So they arrested me on charges of being in the IRA. There's no evidence, but they brought me in and sent me to Cumberland Road Jail. So I was the first Catholic to be done under a thing called the Diplock Courts. Diplock Courts had been just brought in by the British to try and defeat the Nationalists and the Republicans in the North. It was a no jury. It was like internment, but it was a no jury. It was a British judge. You'd have no jury on it. And I was the first Catholic to be brought in under it. It was the first, it was history being made. And I remember went in, and UVF and UDA were all being given £10 fines for being in UDA. And I was charged with membership of the IRA. So my wee solicitor, Pascal O'Hara, God love him, he says, Sam, you're going to be fined £30. I almost said, I mean, £30? Where the fuck am I? Where are we going to get £30? You know, my dad said, don't be worrying, we'll get it somehow, you know. So I went up, front of this side judge, you know, Laurie, never forget the bastard. And he says, you know, Muller, you're a dedicated terrorist. Now, I'm 16. So I'm going, oh, what's this dedicated terrorist? You know what I mean? What the hell is this all about? He says, I've been reading your record here, and you're a dangerous man that needs to be taken off these streets. What you've done in the past and what you no doubt would do in the future, but I'm here to make sure you don't do it. He says, I'd love to give you 8 years, but I can't. I can only give you 3. And I said, what? 3 years, what? He says, 3 years in prison, and hopefully you'll learn your lesson by the time you get out. I was just flabbergasted. I thought, £30 fine, walking home to the rest of the mates and all, waiting for me outside Cumberland Road Courthouse, and there I am, carted off the long case. 16, you know, it's fucking shattered.
Sam, tell us what like your first few days were like in there, because obviously it was a shock to the system to get the 3 years. What's your first couple of days like in prison then?
Well, the good thing about Cumberland Road, you're in Cumberland Road, Oman, all Republicans, all political status at the time. And I remember I was in, I never really had much, but you're taken care of. You're getting a food parcel. So we're all together. So people from better off here, especially in West Belfast, who are always getting taken care of. I mean, they're the fucking sissies. The fucking war, like, are always getting everything that's coming, you know what I mean? I'm from North Belfast. I'm not getting a few crumbs, you know what I mean? But when you go in there, we're all one family. So these guys are all getting their food parcels. It was happy days for me. I'm getting fucking food I've never seen in my life. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it was great. So for me, it was like, Butlins, you know what I mean? You know, here's me fucking out, hoping to never get out of this place, you know what I mean? It's bloody marvellous. But there you're, it's good men, you're with good comrades, you know what I mean? A lot of them are dead and I've been shot dead and all. Like, and they looked after me. We were older men, older Republicans. That's only a wee lot. I was very naive, you know. But I remember they took care of me like older brothers would, or father. There was a lot of really old Republicans in different campaigns, and I always remembered, you know. That's when I started to become a true Republican. I started to appreciate being a Republican and what it meant, the sacrifice that these men had done all their life and endured, you know what I mean? And I started to learn, and I think Cumberland Road matured me. And I thought to myself, you know, when I get out, whenever I do get out, I will become a good IRA man. I will become an IRA man. I will hurt the British. And that's what I did. Because I was trained to T. Once you get into Long Case, all you do is train. Physical exercise, history books, and military training.
Yeah.
And that's what I was busy. Maybe once a month, you'd be getting a bit of a preview, you'd like to watch Kojak or something. You were going, fuck, that was great. Wasn't it watching Kojak last night? And then tomorrow morning, you're back again, jumping over tables and all this. Yeah, I hate it. I don't like to be honest with you, because I'm not into physical exercise, you know what I mean? Like, but that's what you wore till the day I got out, Long Case, working, history, military.
Yeah, well, that's what it was. It's a military regiment, isn't it? Essentially, yeah.
Definitely.
Would you say that more radicalised you?
Million times.
Than Jim being murdered?
Yes.
Really, yeah.
I really became the person that I am today because of going to Long Case. Had I never went to Cumberland Road, Long Case, no way would I have been a person. It changed me, it matured me, it made me a new person. It made me a 30-year-old, even though I was only 16. It made me a 30-year-old man who looked back with embarrassment at myself, at the kind of an idiot I was, that my brothers were trying to drill into me, which had no effect, but I changed. Long Cash changed me forever. Yeah.
Sam, what was the Battle of Long Cash?
Yeah, Battle of Long Cash. Jeez, can you not be a wee bit happy here for about 5 minutes, you know what I mean? The Battle of Long Cash, tell you what happened. In Long Cash, it was quite lackadaisical, you know. It's a big friggin' internment camp. You know, it's like one of them old World War II Coolidge movies that you see. You know, if you can picture it at all, it was like 100 Republicans in each cage, as we called them, you know. There was about 10 cages throughout. Two of them were loyalists, full were loyalists, you know. Funny, my uncle was among them, a loyalist. Me and him used to talk every morning. He used to say, what the fuck are you talking about, orange bastard? You know? But what happened, Billy McKee was the OC, very famous Republican. Billy McKee, he's a very, very legendary Republican, old Republican. He had a sort of an agreement that there'd be no escapes and be no trouble. You know, it was quite easy, like a days ago place. Like, it was nice, like, you know what I mean? And as soon as he got released, a new man took over command, Davy Marley. Brilliant man, brilliant commander. And he sort of says, the days of Butlins is over here. We're going to fucking start doing things. So escapes were arranged. We weren't allowed to escape. When Billy McKee was the OC, that was a fucking thing, you know. It was a strange thing saying to us, don't escape. I mean, the Irish, the greatest escapers in the world, and you're telling them you can't escape from this place, you know. So that was put into place. Escapes started happening, and the screws started then coming down heavy, trying to inflict things on us. But I remember Davy Marley went out to the governor because they were trying to stuff food parcels and all. They were really starting to put the heavy hand on us because the new Davy wasn't going to take any more shit from the screws and all, you know. And Davy went and says to the governor, if this starts, you just keep on, miss, we're going to burn this place to the fucking ground. The governor laughed at him. He threw a cigarette later at him and says, there you go, burn that, what's that? And he fucking did. He burned it to burned it to the ground with a cigarette lighter from the governor, you know. And the start of it was great. It was burning all the cages. The only cage that didn't burn, by the way, I have to tell you, was the cage that Jerry Adams was in. You know, remember Jerry looking at us all, he was drinking his coffee, and we were getting the shit kicked out of us by a fucking paratrooper later on, like, but that's an our story. I don't want to be written the back of him. I've done enough of it. But it was great burning the cages, you know. Fucking zombie. Fires we've seen all over Belfast. It was red all over Belfast because I could see the flames from Lisburn. These things were sky high. Went on for days. The burning, the smoke was everywhere, you know. And we were all, yes, yeah, great. Fuck, see you next day. We sent in the Marine Commandos. They sent in the paratroopers, sent in tanks and fucking helicopters. So the helicopters first came in low. They had this stuff called CR gas, never used. It was used in Vietnam. It was banned forever, but they started using it on us. And we all started hallucinating. I mean, I was seeing Mickey Mouse and all. You know, I know it's funny now, but I was running around with Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck. I know they were my mates, but I thought it was Donald Duck and all, you know, and I was here. If you read on the Brinks, it gives you a better detail, you know, of what happened. But what this gas did, it was hallucinations. You didn't realise what was going on, and all of a sudden the Marines were coming in different directions. We were all caught in a big football field, it was a big Gaelic field, and they came in two different directions, and it just beat the fucking shit out of us. I mean, I was knocked unconscious a few times, all sorts of fucking beating, you know what I mean? But everybody, a lot of guys suffered really bad beatings, got disfigured and things like this here, you know? But the CS guys, the CR guys, they came down, right? They were coming down so close to you. I mean, the blades, your hair, you couldn't breathe. And then they're throwing the gas right down at you. They were standing or sitting on the edge of the helicopters, just hitting you in the head. And then the splinters, they had these things splintered into 20, 30 parts, and they were hitting the next guy next to you. We were just hitting them up the face. And it was quite horrendous. That went on for about 8 hours. It was hand-to-hand combat. I'll never forget it. Like, you know, I was glad to get knocked out, to be honest with you, you know me, because then you're getting relieved. I'll never forget. It was a young British soldier. He was only about, must have been about 17. And we're all in there, we all had to do press ups. This is a paratrooper's making us, and we're all exhausted. We're smelling the gas, we're fucking slaughtered, the blood's pouring out of us. The paratroopers are making us do all these press ups, you know, laughing, kicking us and all. But I remember we fucking paratrooper, he must be only 18 or something, a wee cadet. He tapped me on the shoulder, says, come on, you. I thought, fuck, I'm in for a beating here, you know. He took me away and he offered me a cigarette. I didn't smoke. He said, what was all that about, man? He said, that's fucking mad, you serious, you know what I mean? I said, mate, we're treating us like dogs. He said, I know, but fucking hell, look at the devastation you've done. Millions of pounds of damage. And that time, millions of pounds was money, like, yeah, like big money, you know. So me and him's talking. He's talking, I'm from Newcastle, I'm working class and all. And he's saying, like, my family, and I'm listening to this guy. And I actually can relate to what he's telling me. It's just the conditions of what we live in over in Newcastle. Like, it's just that the army was my way out and getting a good ways. I'm seeing the world. This is a wee lot of time. He's only about 18 year older than me. Like, and I'm just thinking to myself, fuck, this is the way I could have been, working class. If maybe I'd have joined the British Army, you know, if the situation had arose differently, like, know what I mean? Like, but that was the start of it. But there's so many horror stories that went on. I was lucky. I only got a few freaking kickings, like, you know what I mean? But there's guys got the face for life and all the beatings that they got. They lost their noses and their jaws, disfigured and all, like, you know.
How long did it go on for?
The battle only went on for one day.
Right.
But for 8 hours. But it was intense. But the afterwards, for months, when the winter came, and we had no shelter. They put us in the open during the winter. The snow was coming down on top of you. You had no shelter, no food for the first month. They were giving you scraps. Then you got a one bowl of stew a day, a one bowl of porridge. That's when I started bringing him. It was a big kick up about no conditions because a priest came in, you know what I mean? A fucking priest of all things. I mean, a scumbag priest, but all, it did open his mouth, like, you know what I mean, for a change. So we started getting a bowl of porridge in the morning, a bowl of porridge at night. It was fucking the greatest porridge and stew I ever tasted. I swear to God, I mean, I never tasted stew and porridge like in my life. It's great, like, you know. Then they moved us out. I've lost it for about 3 months. I was meant just to punish you really severely. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. You thought it was never going to end. You thought you're going to fucking be here forever. But then they moved us into new cages. It was like getting into a new house.
Yeah.
You know, a TV and a new bed and linen and all. Like, we hadn't had a shower in fucking 3 months. Like, you know what I mean? Like, so it was fucking paradise again. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
But that was the first fight. That was the first main battle we had with the Brits, hand to hand.
Yeah. Just a little more.
What's the difference between DIY and doing it yourself? It's the difference between a part-time passion and a full-time business. Wix gives you the power to turn your passion into a moneymaker. With a website that fits your unique vision, let your ideas flow with AI that guides you but keeps you in the driver's seat. Manage your business from one dashboard and keep it growing with built-in marketing features. It's time to turn your daydream into your dream job. Go to Wix.com.
Life insurers put life into the things you live for. The new factory that's hiring your neighbors. Maintenance on the bridge that keeps traffic flowing. The paycheck that puts pizza night on the table. Life insurers contribute $8 trillion to communities and local economies through bond purchases and other investments. And protect the financial security of 90 million American families. Like yours. See how life insurers put life into America at ACLI.com. Paid for by the American Council of Life Insurers.
Everybody sleeps, but no two people sleep alike. At Coop Sleep Goods, we celebrate the way you sleep differently. We believe everyone deserves a great night's sleep with their own pillow. And the adjustable, customizable Coop pillow makes it easy. Whether you're a side sleeper, back sleeper, or even a starfish, we've got the perfect pillow for you. Crafted with our innovative memory foam and microfiber fill, our hypoallergenic pillows adjust to you, not the other way around. Just tailor the fill for the perfect fit. Add some in, take some out, until your pillow's just right for you. See why luxury hotels and spas worldwide feature Coop Sleep Goods, and why we have tens of thousands of five-star reviews. With our 100-night risk-free trial, you've got nothing to lose, except those sleepless nights. Get 25% off your first order when you visit coopsleepgoods.com/comedy. That's coopsleepgoods.com/comedy.
Tell us about when you got out then, Sam. How old were you when you got out and how did things change for you then?
When I got out, I'd served most of my time. Sometimes you get out for good behaviour and all that, but because of the long cash, I lost all my, you know, commission or something, that's going to call it something for good behaviour anyway. But so I got out, I was about 18, you know, and the first thing I wanted to do, well, second thing, because the first thing I wanted to do was get a girl, but the second thing I wanted to do was get into the Brits, you know, went back into ASU, back into fucking really, all this training I'd learned, but I hadn't had a fucking guns or anything, you know what I mean, like it was all fucking paper stuff, you know what I mean. So the first thing in my head was to damage the Brits as much as possible, like, you know what I mean, that's what I did, that's why I went back to ARA and became an active service member. I was notorious. I did actually start to earn a notorious name in the ARA, you know. I mean, it's a well-known fact. Like, I'm not just sitting here saying that, like, you know what I mean? But had they not sent me the long case, it would never happened. But I'd done as much damage to them as what they did to me, you know.
And was that the plan then? Like, that was your full intention?
That was my plan. I was a dedicated Republican. Everything else was nothing. My family meant nothing to me anymore. My whole dedication was the Republican movement. Everything else was secondary, didn't matter. I lived for it 24 hours a day. You know, if I had to go out in an operation, I was out in an operation, a man could call again for an operation within 24 hours, didn't make a difference to me. That's what I lived for. Even though I knew I'm going to be killed, I always suspected in the back of my head I was going to be killed.
That's what I wanted to ask you, Sam. Was that concern in your head all the time?
Never left my head. And I always wonder, am I going to feel this shit? Is it like somebody hitting you with sleds, hammering in you die? Or I wasn't afraid then. It was the pain, I think, of when a bullet hits you in the back of the head. How long is the pain going to last? It's terrible. I know it sounds strange, you're going to die, but you're worried about the pain. I thought, it's going to be horrible. I'm going to get shot in the back of the head. I hope I don't live too long. You know what I mean? I hope it's over with. But I always thought in the back of my head, am I going to be shot dead, back of the head, or blew up, you know, for a bomb. And that was what I lived with. You know, not to sound dramatic. I'm sure every AR man that I know live the same. But they might be a bit bravado and go, I didn't give a shit. Believe you me, beneath it all, they were shouting themselves. That, you know, it could happen any time.
Yeah, you said you went out on operations, Sam. Was it heavy stuff you were doing?
Well, I don't know if you called heavy stuff. It was going in to demolish Belfast. It was going in to blow the shit out. I mean, I was copper bombs and machine guns in the city centre. I wasn't going in there to buy something out of Woolworth. You know what I mean? Like, we were squealed on. There were six of us in the van. One of many operations. I mean, the Brits know I was involved in many operations. Like, you know what I mean? And I'm not talking, I lose talk, you know. But they're always after me, and I was always one step ahead of them. You know, I never went back to home. I never slept in the house again. I never went back home again, ever. I was always in safe houses. My life had changed. I never had a social life. Didn't go to discos anymore. You know, simple things like that there. But I was just one skip ahead of the British, the cops, you know. But of course, eventually you're going to get caught.
Mm.
There's no question about it. And I had the opportunity to go down to Free State and stay, but I didn't do that because I says, well, the war's not in the Free State. The war's up in the north. I had a lot of friends that went down Free State. I'm not saying anything against them. That was a choice that they took. But I couldn't do that. My conscience didn't allow me to do it there, you know. So that was about it. That's what I lived for.
You said you got caught with guns and ammunition.
Yes, well, we got caught. There were six of us in a big van. It was like loads of bombs, loads of machine guns. And one of the men that was with me was Larry Marley. He ended up being assassinated by the loyalists. But he was actually the mastermind behind the biggest escape in Europe. And the H Blacks, when 32 men, Irish Republican Army men, escaped, he was the mastermind behind it. So me and Laurie, a couple of hours, had come to the top of New Lodge. We'd come out of Ardoyne, and next thing, a foot patrols just came out of nowhere. We're all right, being squealed. And we didn't know us. It was a Sunday morning, you know. It was a beautiful Sunday morning. Never forget it. We're all having a laugh in the van. Like, you know, it's funny you're going into town to blow the fucking shit out of Belfast, and you're all having a laugh about it, like, you know what I mean? But the van opened, and the British soldiers came in. We're all missing. And next thing, was a 50 cups battle between us. On the hand fighting between the Brits. We all got away. Fired shots. I don't know. I always kept waiting for that terrible head blew off. I always had this fear in my head, back ahead. You know what I mean? I kept running down the needles. I remember shots. And I kept thinking, I'm going to be shot dead now. But we got away. And then when we eventually got away, the Brits surrounded our Europe. That's an our story about how I got away. But I went back to active service within 2 days. You know, I went and had a bit of a break after getting caught, a bit nervous after this year. But we were counting on by top tout. He's dead now, but I went back to active service immediately, almost 24 hours, and within about 3 months I was caught again, right? But this time I couldn't get away from it. I was caught red-handed in the Crumlin Road with a gun, going to do something, and, you know, and that was the start of me going back into the H-blocks.
Yeah, so you go into the H-blocks now with this. What is the sentencing like there? What do they, you're an active member of the IRA, do they give you a heavy sentence?
What had happened was Margaret Thatcher had been elected in Britain. And she was out to destroy the Republican movement to try to criminalise them, make them into like these mafia gang, you know. Of course, it didn't work with the North. People in the North, especially nationalists, knew they are there to defend them, you know. But this was her policy worldwide, trying to make it out that they are not but criminals, you know what I mean? So they took away a thing called political status. Political status, when I was in the first time, as I said, it was like nice living in a constant, you know, you're living like Butlin sort of a thing, like, you know what I mean? But all that was taken away. This was a draconian jail now you're going into. These special things called the H blocks. They were designed actually by the Nazis during the Second World War. Blueprint to murder the Jews, to suffocate them and all this here. This was actually a blueprint that she took. And they're escape proof. That's what she was boasting to the world. These are escape proof. We're going to put them in here. These are criminals. And they'll be treated like ordinary criminals. So the first thing that you do, I was sentenced to 10 years. I got 10 years. Could have got 4 years if I'd recognised the court. But I didn't. Refused to recognise the court and got 10 years. Got the maximum that they could give me, you know what I mean? You know? So I went in, and the first thing you go into H blocks, I'll never forget, it was in winter. And the first thing you do, you go into reception. So it's like a room, it's no bigger than this place here. There's about 10 screws on it, you know? These are all loyalist fucking screws. First thing they say to me, take off your clothes. I just come from a court, just been sentenced. So straight in, down into long cash, into H blocks. Take your clothes off. Took all my clothes off and put you on a wee locker sort of a thing. Next thing, screw, come to a prison gear, this criminal outfit, uniform, you know, closes the door, says, hurry up and get that, Muller, get on you, you're going up to his blocks to work. So I just stared at it, you know, I'm standing there naked. Door opens again, the screws there, and he said, what the fuck's wrong? You don't hear me? Put that uniform on you, hurry up and get up here. Having all night waiting for you. Slammed the door again. Next thing, the door opens again, he sees me standing there, he says, oh, is that the way you want it? Next thing, a couple of screws. we'll put it on you if you don't, it's up to you. So it took me out, a lot of fights, trying to get me to bear this, trying to put the clothes on me. It didn't work. So next thing, it grabbed me by the ankles. I'm naked. They train me all the way up. This is night, winter. Train me up by the ankles, two or three screws, and you're through all this tarmac. Your back's all getting fucking shredded. You're fucking ballic naked. You know, it's the middle of winter. The director bringing you up into a fucking ice box. And I tell you, see if you've ever seen a horror film, you had Frankenstein movies, and you look at the castle in the background, you're saying to yourself, fuck, I'd hate to be in that place. That's a ice box. So you're going into this place, and you've heard all these rumours. Nobody's ever been in the ice box before. Just the rumours that's coming out of them, what it's going to be like. You know, they're specially designed to fucking torture you, you know what I mean? Like, so I remember getting in, and the thing that brought me into reception, all the screws are there waiting with the buttons, and they're banging them. You know, it's psychological, trying to scare shit out of you. Didn't need to do it. I was all right. Fucking shit was blown out of me, you know what I mean? But they had me up, and I was covered in blood. All the fucking smacks of the screws were giving me with buttons and all this here. I was covered in blood. And I had the governor sitting there. They had me stand up in front of my naked. They're holding me up. So he's looking at me, and where'd you get them bruises, Muller? I never says anything. Sir, call the governor, sir. No, I said, I always met my father. You never, ever call anyone, sir. You know, it was always drilled into me. There's no man, sir. Nobody's above you. You don't ever call anybody, sir. And I just stared at him. So I got a big slap in the back of fucking ear. You know what I mean? It was fucking hair ringing, like, you know what I mean? One of the screws fucking just gave me a big fucking slap, you know? He says, oh, Miller, where'd you get them bruises? No, listen, that blood's all run down my face. No, I'm not freaking chest, no. No, sir, he got it because you refused to put on your uniform. He slipped in the snow out there. Okay, that's good. Now he's writing it all down, you know. So I says, right, Muller, you're going to go into room 8. You're going to go down there. And then I says, he says to me, sir, call the governor, sir. I says, I'm not calling anyone, sir. I says, I do what my father tells me. He says, oh, your father, he's an Irish bastard. Well, in the IRA, Mom, we know all about him too, you know what I mean? So have me walking naked down the room or down this corridor. And the corridor, I'll never forget, it's so quiet. All you can hear is your bare feet walking on this ground. And you know, and it's going into your head and you're thinking, where the fuck is pitch dark? And all of a sudden, these wee tiny lights. It's lighting up this whole dark corridor. You know, you don't know where you're going. Next thing, the door opens and you're thinking, you've heard all these rumours about these cells and all. What's happening when I go in here? So just threw me in the cell. It's just a wee tiny cell, just a wee tiny room, you know. And slam the door behind you, and you're completely naked, and you're shaking, we're cold, and you're shaking with fear. And the next thing I just hear is a wee voice, and just says, oh, Sam, is that you? It's one of my mates who's been standing before me, you know what I mean? I says, oh, Finbar, you know, so that's where we got your morale going up again, because you're thinking you're on your fucking own here, and all of a sudden there's a mate's voice, you know what I mean? So back again, your courage has come back in, and the next thing I think, is that Muller down there? So there's about four of us, you hear all the different voices, all of a sudden there's about 10 of us in this car, in this fucking wing, you know what I mean? So that was the start of what became a blanket protest, because we refused to wear the clothes. We're all naked for, and I didn't know I was going to be naked for the next 8 years. And during those fucking years, the torture and the beatings that I fucking went through, not just me, my comrades, was fucking horrendous. Horrendous.
I didn't know. I knew the blanket protest, I've heard of it. But I didn't know it was from day one. They only gave you that uniform and nothing else. That was it. That was the only option you had.
What they gave you was, when you went into a room, there was a blanket. They called it a blanket. What was, do you know what a Brillo pad is?
No. A Brillo pad, yeah.
Well, imagine that. Imagine this tablecloth is all Brillo pad made, and that's your blanket. So you're putting it on, and the first thing you start doing is scratching. Yeah. It's cut into you.
Tearing
so that's
skin your blanket. Off, yeah.
That's all you had. Yeah. That was to cover your dignity. So that's what you had. But you're putting that on, it's like being in the Old Testament of the Bible, you know, like some sort of a punishment for you. So that's all you had. But you're completely naked most of the time. I was naked like for years. It was so confusing seeing I got clothes when I finally got his shoes and all. I was fucking ballocks. I hadn't a clue what the fuck was going on with the shoes. And I was like Donald Duck trying to figure a way out to wear the shoes and all. It was terrible.
And so is this just every day? What does the next day look like, Sam? If that's day one, what does the next day look like then? So you're obviously all in this together. We're not wearing this. We're political prisoners. Right. We're not wearing that uniform.
That's right.
What way does it go from there?
The funny thing about it, that every day it's like... Did you ever see a thing called Groundhog Day? Did you ever see a movie?
Yeah, Bill Murray.
Bill Murray. Well, that's exactly what it's like. Every day is the same. You're getting your beatings. You're getting asked by the governor politely. Come off a protest. And you go up in the new block. You get all your clothes. You get all everything you want. Food and all. Television. But you'll be accepting the uniform of a criminal. You understand?
Mm.
And that's all you have to do. Just put that uniform on and you'll have all them luxuries. If you don't, you're going to get beatings. And the minute you say no to the governor, he goes and the screws come in and they start beating the fuck out of you. You know, I mean, I'm talking about beating. I'm not just talking about a couple of kicks up the arse or anything. I'm talking about beating. The only thing it saved you was that many screws trying to kick you. They were kicking themselves more just to get at you. You know what I mean? But the fear of getting beat every day, it was another monster that you had to contend with, you know, because you always knew that the screw was going to beat you. Not the screw, the screws were going to beat you. You know what I mean? And you're naked. It's quite hard to fucking fight when you're fucking naked. You know, there's a psychological thing or two, you know what I mean? But these men, I'd call them men, shouldn't I call them that, these screws, did that gladly, laughing, you know, every day they did that. And they would go home to their wives and kids and sit down and have a nice meal, you know, and talk how life is, you know, my nice job, because they were getting money. The money they were getting was three times normal from what they were getting. And the terrible thing, they had screws from England, Scotland, and guess where else?
Yeah.
Dublin. They brought the Dublin screws in to listen to Gaelic speeches that we were talking. And we were talking Gaelic to each other, so the screws couldn't understand it. So look, they defeated that purpose by bringing screws up from fucking Mountjoy. Shameful, I don't like. But there you go.
Sam, I've read so much about these hedge blocks, and I've heard you speaking before about some of the horrific things that's gone on. And something that I wanted to ask you about was a thing called forced washing.
Oh, fuck, that's lovely.
Like, it sounds like the most horrific thing in the world.
Yeah, you have to remember your dignity. See, journalists, you try to keep yourself, your dignity, you know what I mean? But imagine you're naked. Now, you think if you're naked in front of a man who's clothed, you know, and they're making snide remarks, and then they're slapping you in the face, and they're kicking you in the balls, and all this here, and then you're going from wing shift to wing shift. This is another thing, how they broke you down, making you move from one wing to another, and they'd wait for you in a circle, 10 screws, bend you over a table, open up your arse, stick your fingers in, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to go into too much detail, but the forced washing was horrendous. What they used to do was, they had this doctor, so-called doctor, but they got the family got a doctor who was willing to do it, and he'd come down, and he'd open to a nice polite English accent, you know, lovely, lovely accent, you know what I mean? He'd say, Mr. Miller, you're asked to come for a wash. Will you come, please? Because we weren't out of wash, you see. We weren't going out to get washed because they were beating us up to get washed. So we protested. We started using the cell as a toilet, and that's what became a no-wash protest. I mean, we shit completely over all the walls for years. So you're living in your own shit and pace. I know it sounds terrible, but you had no hard choice, because if you went out, you were getting the shit kicked out of you.
So you had to slap out as well, didn't you?
That's right. We slapped out using the slaps through the door. We never slapped out. Never let us slap out. You know, so you had your piss and your shit. You know where else to do it. So we spread about the walls. No, it sounds horrendous. See, when I was first told to do it, I fucking thought I was going to faint. You know, it's fucking... Because I'm a human being like you, and you're probably thinking, this guy's a robot. He's a fucking madman. That's why he could do it. No, I'm like, mate, you two facing me here. It's horrendous. But you had to fucking do it. There's no other choice. You have no other choice to do it, you know. So your hair, I mean, my hair was way down my arse because not getting a haircut, a beard like fucking Robinson Crusoe, you know what I mean? And you're getting skinny because you're not getting food. You look like a concentration camp victim and your skin's all yellow. Your teeth, it's just a fucking terrible way. So I brought in this doctor, this English doctor. We used to call him Dr. Hacknabus because there's a Marx Brothers film. We'll have this doctor called Dr. Hacknabus, you know what I mean? And Groucho Marx always called him Dr. Hacknabus, you know, like us here. So we end up calling him Dr. Hacknabus. He was a bastard. He was like a German concentration camp doctor, you know? And he come in very nice and say, Mr. Miller, would you come for a wash, please? I mean, we need to get them germs off you. And you just fucking look at him. You wouldn't even answer him. You go, and you go to the screws. Next thing, fucking screws grab you up, legs naked. You're going up a fucking corridor naked, you know, you're looking up, you just saw a member. Next thing, you're through in this big fucking bath, freezing water, ice cold. It just takes your breath away, and you think, fuck, gonna die, and then they put you in under, and you're suffocating, you know, you're underneath the water, like, you know, next thing you feel, this is it, it's lovely, and you feel like, I'm gonna die, so you don't care, and you're welcoming it. You're thinking, thank, it's over. Because you thought you were in hell. You're thinking, this is me over now. This is my punishment. Finish. Next thing, get the scrubbing brushes. And the Ajax, do you know what Ajax is? No. It's like an old chemical scorcher you used to use in the old days for cleaning bathrooms and all. It's like real powder.
It's powder, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
So they're using that and they're throwing that all over you. And then they're getting a scrubbing brush. I'm talking about scrubbing brushes, big long things. You know,
like a deck brush.
Scraping you. And that's all going into your blood and your skin. All like, you know what I mean? And then they're throwing this disinfectant in. You know what I mean? They're pulling you out and they're laughing. They're killing themselves laughing. And I always remember it was a song. You just won't remember. You're too young. Called Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon Garfunkel. And they would play this song because it talked about water, you see. And so water in the bath. And they'd be pissing themselves laughing. And they had the record stuck when it came to the word water. And water, 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 and that's about it, wasn't it? Killing themselves. I used to love that song until I heard it in there and I fucking hate it. And I know every time I hear it, but then you just take it back and you get throw your fucking back in, and then it go for somebody else. You know what I mean? And that's what you had. That's what you're enduring all the time. You know, it's hard to describe unless you went through it. You think of men fully clothed, loving you, and you're naked, and throwing you into a fucking big bath and scrubbing you. You know, it's hard to get your head around. Why men would do that? I mean, I couldn't do it. I wouldn't do it. It takes a special person to do that. A sadist or somebody who's sick or a pervert, something missing there. You know what I mean? Like, as a human being, you couldn't be a human being. I don't think you're a human being. Yeah. You do that. It's torture.
It's hard to believe that someone doing that is their job.
Yeah.
Every day they're getting up in the morning, as you said, they're kissing their wife and kids, good boy.
Exactly, you know, and they storm my life and then their kids love them, saying, oh, my daddy's a great guy and all. Then he goes in and he does that, you know.
Yeah. Mm. And that's every day for 8 years?
That's your life. Yeah, roughly 8 years, you know. That's your life for you.
What was the conditions like in the cells?
Right, first of all, the old cells, the old Victorian cells, like in a common road, were massive. They were massive cells. Like, fucking say they're about 12 foot, 14 foot, I can't tell you, but these cells were very small, probably just about 6.5 foot, very tiny, lengthwise, breadthwise. You could probably stretch your hand out and touch the whole entire cell. But when we started to do the no worse protest, we had to put the shed on the walls. So you're thinking about 8 years of shed, if you can imagine it. Like, you know what I mean? That's an awful lot of fucking shed, you know? So we're putting it on the wall, and your wallpaper and so the entire wall, the entire ceilings, the ceilings, floor, walls is brown, completely brown. For shit, right? And all of a sudden in your head, you're saying this fucking cell's shrinking. Because every time you're putting a shade on, it's like wallpaper that you didn't take off the old wallpaper. It's getting smaller and smaller. And I'm saying to myself, fuck, if I put any more of this fucking, I'll not be able to walk. You know what I mean? This is the sort of stuff that's going through your head. But people always say to me, people have always asked me, says, son, that smell of that fucking shit, you must have want to vomit. And I thought, see, when I first got the orders, we were spreading this on the wall. I thought, how the fuck, I'm going to vomit here. It's a fucking cert. Even though I worked in an abattoir, one of the fucking terrible jobs you could ever fucking have, the smell of fucking animals being fucking slaughtered, like, you know what I mean? It was the pace that killed you. See, pace. Shit lasts for about an hour. The smell, it goes, it's finished. And then you're smelling like tobacco. I know that's, I mean, put you off smoking now, hopefully. But pace never goes away. It's the ammonia that's inside your urine. It never, and it stings your eyes forever. And you always had your eyes rolling. Always. Because you dread it. Seeing your cellmate goes, am I here for a piss? You say, oh, for fuck's sake. Because you've just got over the fucking sting last night of you doing it. Know what I mean? So that comes into the fucking room. Never leaves. The shit was okay. I tolerated the smell of it. And you never, after a while, you don't even smell it anymore. But the urine was her fucking horrendous. And what the screws used to do, when we used to push it out underneath the thing, they had a thing, big thing called a squeeze, big brow Swiss, big rubber. And they come down and push it back in. So your whole cell was soaking with urine. You had a wee tiny thin mattress. It wasn't a mattress, a piece of sponge you're living on. And that was soaked. So you're trying to sleep on that night and smell that fucking pace. You know, it was horrendous. So I always say to people, I didn't mean the smell of shit. It's a terrible thing to say, like, but pace was horrendous.
Yeah, it's just because you mentioned earlier, innit, that you're just a normal fella. And like, the fact is, we're putting shite on the walls, obviously, during the wash protest. How did you manage to last that long?
Yeah. Have you got a brother, any brothers or sister? Imagine you're at home today, and all of a sudden your father was starting to put shit in it. You think, fuck, he's lost his fucking name. We'll have to get him out of here quick. It's just something that a human being is pushed to. And it's scientists from all around the world studied the blanket mail of how to endure that. There was American scientists actually came over, and they were studying how humans can go through that. Because you're thinking, there has to be a breaking point here. Maybe a week will stick it. Because that's what Margaret Thatcher thought. These guys are going to stick us for 2 weeks, you know? And it went on for month after month, and then went into years. Because I thought, see, if somebody had told me, you're going to go on the blanket protest tomorrow, and this is, and they showed me my life for the next 8 years, I probably wouldn't have went on. I would have thought, what? There's no fuck, that's worse than hell. Because I thought I was dead. See, after a while, I started to believe I had done so many bad things on this earth. I was in hell now. Because I stopped believing in God and all. I was non-existent because God wouldn't allow this to go on. You know, maybe for a week. But this went on forever. So I had no family anymore. And this was going on forever. So obviously I've started to figure out I'm in hell. You know? And I thought, well, maybe I'm lucky. Maybe it's only purgatory. Maybe after a while, all your sins get wiped away. You know, you believe in all this about purgatory. You're thinking, well, if I get punished enough, I'll fancy get out of here. Let's hell him and I'll go to fucking heaven to where the fuck I've died. But after a while, I was thinking I was dead. That's why I started to believe, because these things can't be happening. How can it be happening every day? You're getting this, the fucking screws in there, you're getting these baths, these forced baths, and you're getting this. So it's obviously can't be happening. It's in my mind. This is all happening, you know? And that's the way I had it. I had it, this can't be happening. It was only till you get out and you start to break it all down and you go, how could a human being do it now, another human being? And why have the screws never been charged with war crimes? They got medals from Margaret Thatcher and their queen, Lizzie Windsor. They got medals for doing that. If the Russians done that, it'd be worldwide news everywhere. But these desperate Russians torturing political prisoners, you know, because it was done by Britain, it was all covered up. And how can they do it? Get away with it, you know?
What's a routine like on a day in the cells, Sam? Are you in 24-hour lockup?
Yes, 24-hour lockup. You never got out.
Yeah.
There was no, like, we'll let you out for we are, have a, you know, walk around. No, that never happened. So you're locked up in this room. It doesn't become a cell anymore. It becomes like a shoebox. You know, you're trying to make it nice. Because I used to dream up things, because I was good with my imagination, with all the Marvel stuff and all. So I used to think Batman's cave. I'm in Batman's cave here. I'm waiting for that fucker Robin to come in any minute here to make a cup of coffee and all. So I was dreaming all these imaginationy things, you know what I mean? Maybe my other comrades didn't have the imagination I had. I think my imagination saved me a lot of what I went through, you know what I mean? I like to think so, you know what I mean? Because I was able to get away out of this fucking cell, you know what I mean? Like, but a daily routine was, you got up and you didn't know if it was morning because it had all the windows. There was no light. You didn't know what day it was. You didn't know what time it was because all the windows were boarded up. So you're disoriented about the fucking time. There's times you just didn't know what the fuck was going on. You were staggering about like an idiot. And then the screws wouldn't give you the food at the time they're supposed to, like 1 o'clock maybe get your dinner, and now they're giving it at 3 o'clock. Or maybe give it at 10 o'clock in the morning and you're all confused about what day it is and they pretend it's Friday. You know, they say, well, that was a great thing we done last night, letting on it's Friday, you know, shutting down, but it's actually Sunday.
Mm.
So your whole fucking mind's all fucked up, like, you know what I mean? It's millions of wee things that they did, which was just mental torture. You know what I mean? Adding on the pressure of physical torture, you know what I mean? The psychological torture was just as bad. Like, but see out there getting, see you to be put over a table naked, nah, and for somebody to grab you, four men hold you, and then prod their fingers up your fucking arse, like, and you get, it fucking, it affects you. You know, it was rape. Nobody liked me using that word in the book. And I said it was rape. It shocked everybody when the book came out. It shocked for Republicans. I was pulled by top fucking Republicans. Says, Sam, why did you? I said, because it fucking was rape. Mm. You weren't on a blanket protest and you're fucking, I know, but that more. I said, I don't give a fuck. Women were raped. You think men can't be raped? Read the book. You know, it was shagging, but I didn't give a fuck. I didn't pull punches, you know. It was fucking rape. And I said, because people were going mental, well, you shouldn't, like, you know, we're hard men and all. You're saying we were raped and all. That doesn't sound. Afterwards, they all realized how good that book was by saying what happened.
Yeah.
Raped. We're ripped, you know. It's a terrible thing to say.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
And if anything, it'll just put more people on your side because you're calling for what it is and these are the atrocities that are being committed.
Exactly. Because now I hear about being ripped. I know the fucking humiliation, the fucking degradation that they go through. You know, maybe before you just seen it as a fucking, well, it's a rape, you know what I mean? But now I know I sit and I go, oh, fuck, you know. You can't get out of here. It never leaves you.
Yeah.
It never leaves you, you know what I mean? Like, I got my grandkids and all that and that's what I live for. And they brought so much happiness into my life. I never thought I'd have happiness again. Now, I'm talking about real happiness, but I do wake up in the morning, I've got my fucking writing back again, and got my grandkids. And those are the two things that I fucking, see a lot of, no, doesn't mean nothing to me. I was a multimillionaire, and no, and all it did was get me into fucking trouble, you know? But I wake up, and I got my writing, I got my grandkids, and I think, God, I don't know how you're so good to me now. Maybe you're a wee bit ashamed of what you've done to me, and you're giving me these good things again, you know what I mean? But that's what I live for. I live for my grandkids and my writing.
Yeah.
Sam, how did you manage to suppress that after you got out, like you and whoever else was on the blanket protest at the time? How did you suppress that? How did you not speak about that? I understand you were told, like, and it was instilled into all of you.
Yeah.
You don't speak about anything, and that's how it was. But how did you manage?
I'll tell you, but they don't want to talk about it. This is the shameful thing about the Republican Amendment. What happened was when a lot of blanket men got out, became alcoholics, and they lived in parks, and they were deserted by the Republican Movement. You know, and we're mocked. These are guys that went through hell. And a lot of guys had mental breakdowns and we're mocked. You know, it was just that it was a kind of thing. It was a mental culture in the Republican Movement at that time. There's no understanding. I mean, I'm not saying it was evil because it was just a thing it was in Belfast. You know, it was a hard man, sort of a fucking culture that was going on there. But so many blanket men became alcoholics, you know. They just couldn't handle life. A lot of, you know, committed suicide, you know. So much damage done to us afterwards. spot enough what we went through, but the after effects was never ending. It's still never ending. I mean, I met a few blanket men and they don't talk, you know. We do not talk about the fucking blanket. We don't talk about anything. You know, we may talk about something daft, about a fucking movie or something, but we never, ever talk about the fucking blanket. It's a no-no, you know. But I will say this, when the book came out, so many of them came to me, you know. These are macho guys, in secret and all. And said, Sam, fuck you, open that door, lovely, you know. That was it, you know. But it was a macho culture, and shame on the Republican movement the way volunteers were treated, you know. No excuse.
You can see it clearly getting a bit emotional.
Yeah,
there,
I mean, I'm sorry about all this here. It's
no,
just
no, no, don't be sorry at all.
The injustice, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, but it seems to me as well, when you mentioned the book and the response of the book with people's families and men who are there, and you get to see the reaction of people when they read the truth, or when they're maybe looking back and reminiscing on the truth.
Yeah.
You can see it's really affecting you.
Yeah, big time. You know? My publisher said to me something like, when this book comes out, it's going to cause you problems. It's going to cause you... I said, like, first of all, it caused me a lot of problems with my family. My family didn't want people to know about my mother. I was hid. I was our dark secret. You know, and then I wrote a big play up here in Belfast about it. It was massive. It was fucking sold out tickets in Derry and Newry. It was massive. Like, it just went on for weeks and critically acclaimed. But the same way when I wrote the fucking book, I thought, am I going to write a fucking false, a bit of false, just to see people's fucking, you know, they don't want to be hurt and all. I wrote words about my family that I'm on here, but I was also going to write words about everything else. You know, I thought it was a clean fucking memoir, words and all. It was not glorifying anything, you know what I mean? I said the way I seen it, you know what I mean? I'm glad I wrote it. At the time, my publisher said, you're going to have fucking people, you know, coming up to the Republican movement and all, about writing about this the way you went and all. I said, don't give a fuck, Michael. I said, I'm reading, I'm not afraid of anybody, I've never been afraid of my life since I was 15, you know what I mean? I don't give a fuck anymore, like, you know, I went through a bit of shit. I'm not going to talk about it now. I went through a bit of shit with the Republican movement afterwards, but I don't give a fuck. I'm always been my own man, you know what I mean, like, and I'll always will be my own man. I'm glad I'm 70 now, and I'll go to the grave of fucking knowing that I had a good life for what I've done. I've no regrets.
At the end of the day, you just spoke your truth, and that's that.
It, mate. That's all you can do. Live yourself. I don't care about them with people. I live by myself. Conscience, to me, is your ultimate guide. If you can live yourself, then you're a good man.
Mm. Yeah. How did you not just give in and wear the uniform?
Because you're Irish. Mm. You're Irish Republican.
Yeah.
And you believe in it. You know, if I had never fought the Irish, or I never fought the British, sorry, I never fought the Unionists, if I could have stayed second-class citizen all my life and don't be fighting, just live like us, live like shit, you know what I mean, and live off of crumbs. But you're not, it's the Irish instinct in you to fucking fight. And when you become a Republican, you don't take shit from nobody ever again in your life. That's one thing I remember. See, when the minute I knew I was an Irish Republican, I was never going to take shit from anybody ever, no matter who they were, no matter what force he used, you know. Now, men did break, you know, men came off the protest, and I hated them. I hated them more than I hated the fucking screws. Because every time they came off, the screws beat you more. Because 10 Downing Street was telling these fucking screws, yous are winning. And they got bonuses. See, for every time they took a man off, a man gave up, they were getting their bonuses. So that's an incentive. Kick the fuck out of these guys, get them off more and sent more bonuses for us. You know what I mean? So they thought they're winning. And that was every time a man came off. And you hated that man. Even though he was your comrade. Even though he had been out in battle with you. You know, he may have been your best friend outside. All of a sudden, you hated him more than you hated the fucking screws. Because you were saying, like, fuck, you're coming off, leaving me here, you're deserting me. And these screws are going to think they're winning. And they're going to come and get me to beat. And you knew, see, when you heard somebody had come off, we called it squeaky booting. Because once I got the new uniform on, had these brand new boots, and all you heard was it was a sound of them sneaking off the wing. And that's what they got called, squeaky booters, forever. And I fucking hated them, like, because, you know, and even afterwards, you seen them in the street and they couldn't look at you, you know. And it was only for a lot of years afterwards, I started to look back on it and I realized these men had their breaking point.
Mm.
These men had wives and kids where I wasn't married at the time. These men had extra pressure. Their wives just fucking telling them, you got to come off this, you got to get out of that place as soon as possible and get back and get a job. You know, we're living in fucking poverty here, three kids. You didn't know, you didn't believe it because you didn't care. I didn't want to hear fucking sad stories, you know. I didn't want to hear any fucking shit about my granny's dead, my ma died, I'm coming off for a couple of, I don't want to hear that. I lost all compassion, you know?
The causes outweighs all that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you had no visitors or anything?
No, I never seen my family for fucking 8 years. And the day I finally seen my father, he didn't know me. He didn't recognize me. I was coming out of the gate. Him and my brothers were coming to meet me. You know, me finally got out after about 8.5 years. I think I was, I can't remember exactly. I was 10. I lost all my mission, and I was coming out the gate. A couple of our guys had just come out. I remember him standing there. My father changed. Of course, I hadn't seen him in 8 years. He'd aged. Brothers were there, and they were looking over me, looking beyond me. They couldn't believe who I. They didn't know who I was until I went up to them. They started crying because I was so fucking skinny. My skin, I looked like an old man of 90. You know what I mean? Like, just couldn't fucking believe who I was. You know what I mean? So that's where body conditions were. People didn't recognize me when I got out in the streets, and you could see they were shocked, but they didn't want to say it. Last time you're looking well, and you're thinking, you fucking drunk. Mm. I'm looking well. But they were saying, of course, because I didn't want to embarrass you because how bad you were looking. Like, I mean, none of my clothes ever fitted again, like, because you were just so skinny. You know what I mean? But your whole man was all fucked up because of what you went through. And they couldn't see that. They could only see the physical things that had been done to you. Yeah. But they couldn't see what was going on in your mind. Mm-hmm. You had changed. I changed forever.
Mm.
The only thing where I'm thinking, hey, Sam, is how did you not go insane?
Yeah, people did go insane. It's that ARA thing. It's a mental thing. Terrible thing to say at the time. You know, it was a mental thing. But if you didn't have it, men would have came off. See, if men thought it would have been easy to come off, that we weren't going to talk to them again, or we'd be best mates. That's all right, mate, go ahead, I'll see you next time. They would have come off, but you couldn't allow that. I was going to break a protest. It's not because you really fucking hated them, it's because you couldn't break this protest. Margaret Thatcher was going to win. They were going to criminalise the whole Republican movement, you know? So everything was at stake here. I wanted to come fucking off. I wanted the easy life. I wanted to go fucking up and have a fucking TV and not get beat up. Imagine, like, why the fuck do you think I wanted to get beat up every day? Tortured every day? No, I want that over with. But I wasn't going to give in to it. There's not a hope on earth of me giving in. So if I'd have been there for 100 years, I'd still be there. And that's the Irish fucking instinct in you.
Yeah.
Automatically becomes it. When you know you're fighting the British and you've got that in you, they're not going to defeat you. And everyone has their fucking breaking point. I understand that. And maybe my breaking point would have come another day after the 8 years. Maybe the next day was going to be my breaking point, but it never came. But I had my breaking point, obviously, but I just never came.
Yeah.
So you never actually broke the protest, Sam. You just, your sentence was finished.
I've done the whole sentence. And not only that, is when the protest sort of basically ended, what they were trying to do, we had a new OC took over and started sending out word, we're going to end the protest. For a number of reasons, it was because we're short of men outside and we're all lingering in here. There's a lot of good fucking operators. And the RAW outside was thinking, we need to get men back out in the fucking battlefields, you know what I mean? Because all these men are just fucking lingering here. So I remember the OC sending word round, sort of seeing how the men were feeling. Finish a protest. Look, the lads have all died in hunger strike. We've got a lot of what we were looking for. Blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? But I remember when I heard it, I thought, you know something, I'm not coming fucking off a protest. You know, I'm not coming off a fucking protest. I didn't lie here for 8 fucking years to go fucking up now and do all what we could have done 8 fucking years ago. You know? But I remember the school coming down to me and says, you're only one. There's only a couple of reasons who's refusing to disobey orders. I said, I don't give a fuck. You know, man, I'm not doing it. So I thought I was only one staying. Everybody came off the fucking protest. And I thought I was the only one. Next thing I hear somebody coming down, it's one of my mates from West Belfast, Big Blute, and he came in. He said, oh, fuck, Muller, I knew you'd be fucking staying. You know what I mean? So me and him stayed. Next thing, there were two, it was six of us. It ended up six of us. I remember the OC coming down, trying to put pressure on us. He says, you're causing fucking dissent outside. People are hearing it. There's people that didn't come off it. You're causing major problems. You're causing major problems about the men. The men are going to come back on the protest. So it was a fucking big, big fucking thing, you know, because we were causing problems. But I'd say, I didn't give a fuck. The area could have said, we're going to shoot you as soon as you get home because you're fucking doing something. I didn't give a fuck. I didn't go through all this here to come off it now.
Mm.
You know what I mean? I said to myself, I've only 2 years left. I'll stick it for 2 years. And then the OC came down and then he says, I don't want you to force me to say this. We've got a big escape happening. It's going to be the biggest escape ever in Europe. And Laurie Marley, my mate, he engineered it all. He was behind the whole thought of it. And I threw away a lot. I thought, how the fuck are you talking about an escape? Nobody can escape from this place. It's fucking impossible. He says, we need you six to stay behind, tie up the screws, make sure nobody's caught. He says, it's up to yourselves. It's going to be fucking selfies and let these men get caught. These men are life. They're going to try and get out of here. And you six fuckers can stay here and wallow in your self-pity. Or can help us get your comrades out. So, of course, when you're hit by that sort of fucking talk, you're thinking, But I said in the back of my head, well, I'll go and do it, but I'll be back and down here the next day. So after the escape's over, one way or the other, if it ever happens, I said, there's not going to be an escape. This is all bullshit from him to get us six to come off. But of course, it was an escape. And we played the big instrumental part in Cold and Screws, where at least 36 men escaped. It was the biggest escape ever in Europe. I mean, to get out of that, the fucking... I'm still amazed how they got out of it. You're talking about 20 gates full of screws to get past. They fucking did it.
Yeah. You made the film about it.
See if it had been British soldiers escaping out of Germany. There have been 200 movies made.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. But because it's the Irish, no, fuck it. Suppress all that. Yeah. Censor that.
Do you make that film Mayes about that?
Yes. It was Laurie was the main character in it.
Yeah.
It was all right.
Yeah. You know? You think...
Let's not get excited.
Yeah.
You know? It was okay. I know a couple of actors and all, and I give them abuse afterwards, like, but it wasn't bad, really. But they had the screw who wasn't a bad screw. He was the screw who went home to his wife and kids. He was trying to help the prisoners. At one time, I thought, Mickey Mouse, no, Disney's.
Yeah.
Because Balix, a lot of shit. So he was the good screw. He had the wife and kids he was going home to, and these bad, bad boys were trying to escape and give him a hard time after him being nice to them, you know? So I just thought, whoever fucking wrote that piece of shit until it, you know what I mean? Like, but yeah, it wasn't bad, really, for a fucking stupid sort of a fucking film, like, you know what I mean? Like,
how had the world changed, Sam, when you grew? So you grow, you see our family, you're completely changed, they're completely changed. What's the world like now for you?
The world's very scary. You can't talk to anybody. Your voice refuses to talk to people. So people, when I got out and I could hardly talk to people. People were getting an attitude was, fuck, he thinks he is somebody now. He's not talking to us. You couldn't talk. I couldn't communicate with my father. You know, my father was saying things, crying, hugging me, and telling me all the latest news about who died and who got this and who got... And I was just like staring at him thinking, fuck, wish I was back in the cell. I can't handle this. I can't handle all this fucking noise coming at me, you know? And people want to see you and people want you to go and do a meeting and stand in the street and talk to all these people that are gathering. And you thought, fucking no way am I fucking, I don't want to know any of you. It's not that I don't want to know you. I just can't do it.
Mm.
I'm fucking ready to collapse here or a nervous fucking break now, you know? But I'm trying to be strong, you know? But that's all I did. I just kept away from people. I shut away from people. And people told me years later, I said, it's like, Sam, we thought you were somebody. You were James Connolly because you wouldn't talk to us. I said, man, I was on a fucking verge of a fucking nervous breakdown.
You were institutionalized.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't understand. You're trying to stop yourself because you know it's only a little thing and you'll break down. You will break down mentally. You think, I didn't break down the H blocks, but now I'm outside. I'm going to break fucking down. I can't do it. I can't afford it. If it means shying away from people, too fucking bad. That's what I had to do. I didn't want to communicate. Didn't want to get back into that fucking whole grind again of this is the world, you know? And it changed. My mates had all got married. I hadn't seen me in 8 years, you know? And I thought I'd be the madman because I was a fucking madman. I had a reputation. Mad Muller, that was my nickname, you know, in the fucking IRA. And all of a sudden, there's this guy's not talking to nobody. He's just staring and nodding and walking past people. And they're thinking, what the fuck is that all about? They just didn't understand. It wasn't until I wrote On the Brinks that people started to understand the hell the prisoners had gone through. Wives had broke up with their husbands. Families had been destroyed because of the H-blocks, because of what they went through. And it wasn't until that book came out that people understood why their husbands changed, you know. And see, the wives, the ex-wives and all came to me and said, Sam, we didn't know this was going on. My husband wouldn't talk about it. He never told us what happened to him, you know. And it wasn't until I started to read my book On the Brinks, everybody started to understand what people went through. That was it, you know.
Right, so that's it for this part. We're still to come this week.
Didn't know much bad. I thought maybe $250,000. You know, I didn't know about much value money would be, you know what I mean? And the next thing, the fucking engine in the car starts blacking out. All the smoke comes flying out of the engine. It's a wee tiny fucking car, a Revan, like, you know. And we had to get back out because there's too much money on it. So we get out and start pulling the money back out. And all the time, gates starting to turn, the lights are going, spinning, the gates going to come down, we're going to be trapped, we're going to be fucked.
See us tomorrow. Boom.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app. What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your whip in it now. Fill your body up in. Work it hard and long. When you finish that.
The hip knocker.
You set the gold standard for your business. Your website should do the same. Wix puts you at the helm so you can enjoy the creative freedom of designing your site just the way you want. Want someone to bounce your ideas off? Talk with AI to create a beautiful site together. Whatever your business, manage it from one place and tie it all together with a personalized domain name. Gear up for success with a brand that says you best. You can do it yourself on Wix.